How much land does the federal government own? How much should it own? And how should it acquire the land that it does own or control? We ask these questions and hopefully give you some answers next on Principles and Policies. Hello, this is Chuck Michaelis. I'm the Vice Chairman of the Institute for Principled Policy, and I'm also the Executive Director of Camp American. The normal host of this program, Barry Sheets, is not available to record this week, so we are doing what we often do, and that is providing some content from a class taught at Camp American in 2012. In 2012, Pastor David Whitney of the Institute on the Constitution taught a class called The Federal Land Grab. And in light of some things that are going on out west especially, but in other areas as well, we thought that this particular program would be a kind of a pretty good on-topic, timely program to run. Because what Pastor Whitney talks about is the constitutional issues regarding federal land ownership, federal control, even often of privately owned land, and what effects that has and how they got in that place. Now, the Constitution is very clear. The federal government is only allowed to own land in the states. For instance, in Ohio, it's only supposed to be allowed to own land in the state with the permission of the state legislature. And only for things like what are called in the Constitution needful buildings, dockyards, magazines, arsenals, places where administrative buildings and those kinds of things. The language is pretty clear. The federal government isn't supposed to own land that it doesn't need and only allowed to do so with the permission of the state legislatures. Well, the situation is a little different in the western states because the federal government, when a lot of these states came into the union, dangled statehood in front of them. A lot of them wanted to be members of the union, but they were told at the time that the only way to become a member of the union was to surrender vast tracts of land to the federal government for their ownership. Why is that? Well, to be quite honest, I don't understand why, except that the government really believes, there are people within the government who really believe that the true owners of all land are the government entities, like the federal government, or the state and local and county governments. And for instance, that's why no one seems to realize this. That's why, for instance, you can have your land confiscated for not paying a property tax. Now, that may sound like a radical statement. You think about it. If you can lose your property because you don't pay someone else a bi-yearly rent for it, then who actually owns it? You have essentially purchased the right to call it yours and to put a house on it, and to make improvements on that lot and that house, for which you will pay higher rent, even though you put your own money into it. But really, the county owns it because the county will step in and take it if you don't make your rent payments. And the fact is, the county will, or the state, or the federal government will simply move in and take it by something called eminent domain for things like, very often, redevelopment because maybe your neighborhood is blighted and we could get more revenue out of it if we would simply tear down the houses that are there now and build new ones, or put up a shopping center, or put up some building that the government thinks would be a better idea. The fact is that if that can be done, and actually that particular thing was originally forbidden in the Fifth Amendment of the United States Constitution, at least from the federal aspect. And the Fifth Amendment basically says that private property shall not be taken for public use without just compensation. Public use has a meaning, and that meaning is that it will be used for public things, bridges, roads. Think of things that public right-of-ways for different things. It doesn't mean that the property can be taken and turned over to another private entity for redevelopment. That is not a public use. That is a private use. So we have problems with definitions, And we have problems with people who have broadened the meanings of words, but that's always a problem when you get people who want to use the language as a weapon. The language isn't supposed to be a weapon. It's supposed to be a tool. Well, in any case, we're going to give you a presentation from Pastor Whitney on the federal land grab, and it was done at Camp American in June of 2012. I'm going to not talk so much and turn it over. If you want information on Camp American, that's campamerican.com, campamerican.com. This year, 2014, the camp is held June 15th through the 21st. There is still room. You may want to contact us for information. We'll be happy to get you out a registration form and an information flyer, and you can pick up those things directly from the website. Fill them out and get them in. You can email them to us. You can fax them to us. You can send them by mail. So here's Pastor David Whitney with the Federal Land Grab.
Father in heaven, thank you for this beautiful day that you have made. We know that you are the creator of all things, that all things come from your hands. You not only created this earth, but the entire universe, and therefore you are the one who owns it all, and you have made human beings stewards, particularly through family government. Father, we pray that as we study the issues of federal land ownership, quote unquote, that you would give us an understanding of the law that is our Constitution and the violations of that law. And as we see those violations, understand that those who are doing this are directly violating their oath of office and therefore are accountable to you for this as well. Father, pray that you would use this day in the lives of each person here to further your kingdom, to further their understanding, and to equip us to be the warriors you have designed us to be in this world, in this day, in Christ's name. Amen. Amen. You can be seated. Well, this morning I want to talk about an issue that may not immediately connect to you as to its importance, but let me share a little background about why this issue is important in my understanding. One of the things we do at Institute on the Constitution is, of course, help people understand the United States Constitution, study that Constitution, and be equipped, therefore, to defend the violations against the Constitution that are taking place at the federal level. But those aren't the only issues we need to deal with as citizens. We need to deal with the violations of our state constitutions as well. And that's actually a more difficult task. If you have studied the U.S. Constitution, you might think, well, wait a minute, how could it be more difficult than that? Well, the reason is our state constitutions are much larger than the federal constitution. The U.S. Constitution fits into just a few pages of this little booklet, the entire U.S. Constitution. State constitution for my state of Maryland is a 110-page book, and it's lengthy, and it's small print and all of that. And I understand Ohio is just a little bit shorter than that. Some of the other state constitutions are smaller. But studying the state constitutions is something we're encouraging all of those who get involved in this work of restoring the republic to do, because the state constitution actually offers enormous power to the activist who wants to see government put back within the constraints that our founders designed for it. You see, if you think that you're going to change the mind of a senator very easily who's in Washington, D.C., you've got another thing coming. He has millions of dollars of bribery money, is what it really is, persuading him to do most of the decisions he does in Washington, D.C. So it's very hard to persuade that senator to change his mind. But when it comes to a state senator or a state representative, it's far easier to change his mind because he knows that you, if you're speaking to him and communicating to him, you represent at least 100 people who share your ideas. And if a state senator or state congress or state representative gets 5 phone calls stating the same issue, the same concern, he feels like all of his constituents in the entire state agree with you. Just 5 phone calls or 5 letters stating the same concern, because he represents a far smaller number of people. So in the battle for freedom, in the battle for liberty to restore our constitutional republic, one of the most effective grounds that we can have is at the state level. But we cannot do that unless we know our state constitutions. If we know our state constitutions, then we can effectively argue and explain to those in power why they need to abide by that constitution they've taken an oath to. So one of the tasks that we have at Institute on the Constitution is creating courses for all 50 states in the Union. It's a huge task. We've only finished one to date. That's the Maryland State Constitution. But we have folks around the country who are beginning to take up the task of studying their state constitution and preparing their state constitution to be a course. And I have a number of friends this fall that are going to work with me specifically on building a course for their state constitutions. I have a friend in California when I was out there graduating a class who said to me, he took up the challenge and said, yes, I'm going to study the state constitution. But after he got into the state constitution, he said, David, there's a problem here with California's constitution, and it's not just our current version of the constitution. It goes all the way back to the very first version of the constitution. And it is this, that California entered the union with an agreement to the federal government that certain portion of the land within the state of California belongs to the federal government from the get-go. And the federal government, therefore, has control of this land according to our California state constitution. So he was right. He was saying, you know what? The California state constitution was wrong from the very beginning. Back in 1850, when California entered the Union, they entered an agreement that allowed the federal government to own and control land within their boundaries that was not land that is constitutionally warranted. Let's look at that issue because California, it turns out, is not the only state. There's many, many states, including some states right around you and perhaps some states that you live in yourselves. And the issue is this. The federal government claims that it controls 640 million acres of land. That's a mind-boggling chunk of real estate. They claim that they own and control that land. And you've probably been on some of that land. Anybody been to a national park, national forest, whatever those things are? And they claim that that land belongs to them, whether it's Yellowstone, which is a beautiful park, or some of these others that are not national parks. One is called the Department of the Interior. They claim to control huge tracts of land, especially in the West. Or the United States Department of Interior Bureau of Land Management, or the Forest Service, National Park Service, or National Monuments. All of these tracts of land across our country, they claim that they own this. Well, I want to show you, first of all, the constitutional issues at stake with this claim of land ownership by the federal government. Secondly, I want to show you a history of where that quote-unquote ownership came from. And the history of that is in the enabling acts of the states that entered the Union following the first 13 states. You know how the first 13 states entered the Union? Anybody know how the first 13 states that were the colonies and then the first set of states, how did they enter the Union? That's right. They ratified the Constitution. As soon as they ratified the Constitution, they became part of the Union. Well, all the subsequent states that entered the Union had a little bit of different process, and we're going to look at that process just briefly, the enabling acts for admission of new states. We're going to look at the problems with federal land ownership, and then we're going to look at some solutions that you can be involved with, particularly at your state level. The portion of the Constitution that governs the function of federal ownership of any land or any property, whatever, is Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17. First Clause 1 says Congress shall have power to lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts, and excises. And then skipping on down to 17, Clause 17, that Congress has this power to exercise exclusive legislation in all cases whatsoever over such district, not exceeding 10 miles square, as may by secession of particular states and acceptance of Congress become the seat of government of the United States. What land is that talking about? Washington, D.C., exactly. So Washington, D.C., Congress has the power to exercise exclusive legislation. In other words, Congress has full control over that territory, that land known as Washington, D.C. In addition to that, they can exercise like authority, that is, the power they have over Washington, D.C., that land, they have like authority over all places purchased by the consent of the legislature of the state in which the same shall be. Pause there for a moment. In order for the federal government to own any land within the boundaries of a sovereign state in these United States, they must get permission from the state legislature to own that land, actually to purchase that land. Now notice, they just can't purchase the land for anything they want. They can't purchase it for a national park. It is a very restricted, limited list of five things they could purchase that land for. The erection of forts, magazines, arsenals, dockyards, and other needful buildings. Look at the first four in that list. Those are all military installations of one sort or another. storage of weapons, storage of supplies, arsenals and dockyards for building ships and repairing ships. All of these are military related, which means the final one, the fifth one, is also military related. Other needful buildings. It doesn't even really talk about land. It talks about specific buildings. So the purpose for the federal government owning any land whatsoever and controlling any land whatsoever outside of Washington, D.C., any land within the sovereign boundaries of any of the 50 states, it has to be these five things that are being accomplished by that land. Now, is Yellowstone a fort, magazine, arsenal, a dockyard, or other needful building? Is that what Yellowstone is? No, it's a national park, right? It's not at all meeting that standard. Now, the other part of this that we need to understand that took place is the admission of new states. In other words, in the first 13 states originally, when they came into the Union, did the federal government own any land in those states? No, none whatsoever. Unless a fort was established. For instance, where I live, Fort McHenry is just up the road. And for a while, that was an active military installation. So yes, the federal government had control and ownership of that fort, but that was all. And nothing beyond that. Now, when new states are admitted to the Union, Article 4, Section 3 of our Constitution says the new states may be admitted by Congress into this Union, but no new state shall be formed or erected within the jurisdiction of any other state, nor any state be formed by the junction of two or more states or parts of the states without the consent of the legislatures of the states concerned as well as of the Congress. Now, suppose Ohio and Indiana decided they wanted to join. They wanted to become one state. According to this, what has to happen? Two things have to happen. If Ohio and Indiana were to become one state, what's one of them? Right. Of both states. So the legislature of Ohio and legislature of Indiana have to approve that merger. What else has to happen? Second thing. Exactly. So Congress on the federal level and the state legislatures on the state level have to approve that change. Or if somebody were to say, you know, we want to carve out a section of Ohio. I know some of you in Ohio would like to chop off that northeastern corner, right? You know, and dump it into the Erie, something like that, right? So say you wanted to secede and create a separate state. You could do that. You could literally say, we will have nothing to do with Cleveland and the surrounding territory. I don't know how far you would want to cut out that northeast corner of Ohio and have a good state, you know, a state that holds to, you know, that might be a good thing to do. You could do that. But again, two standards need to be met. The state legislature of Ohio would have to approve of that, and the Congress would have to approve of both of those changes if those changes were to take place. So new states can be admitted, but the process is they have to go through an approval by Congress in that admission. Now, Article 4, Section 3 continues, Congress shall have power to dispose of and make all needful rules and regulations respecting the territory or other property belonging to the United States. Now remember, what property belongs to the United States outside of Washington, D.C.? Yeah, Washington, D.C. And then what are the four or five things? Military buildings, basically. Forts, arsenals, dockyards, etc. So military buildings, those are the property being referred to here by Article 4, Section 3. That property belongs to the United States, and nothing in this Constitution shall be so construed as to prejudice any claims of the United States or of any particular state. So when it speaks of these rules and regulations, it's only regarding constitutionally legitimate ownership of property by the federal government. But this clause is used by the defenders of the federal land grab, the federal control of 640 million acres in our country. This clause is used, well, look, the federal government owns the property, therefore the federal government controls the property. They miss the foundation that, no, the federal government cannot own that property constitutionally. It does not belong to any federal function that is a military installation, nor is it anything to do with Washington, D.C. Additionally, our Constitution in Article 4, Section 4 says that the United States shall guarantee to every state in this union a Republican, that's small r, it talks about a system of government, not a party, a Republican form of government. And this means that all states are to be treated equally. And all states are going to be measured by the exact same standard of how they interact with the federal government. Now, taking all that, let's talk about what took place in the development of our country, because California, one of the debates about when California came into the Union in 1850, California came into the Union in violation of this famous Missouri Compromise. Perhaps you don't remember this in your history lessons, but the Missouri Compromise was a compromise reached in the battle between the expansion of free states and the expansion of slave states. The southern states were fighting for continued expansion of slave states, so as new states came into the Union, those new states would be slave states instead of free states. And of course, the northern states said, no, we don't want any more slave states. We want to restrict the slave states to only those that exist. Well, at that time, of course, Texas wasn't part of the scene, so they would say, no, slavery stops here. There's no new slave states that could be admitted. But the compromise was reached that said, below this line, slave states may be admitted to the Union. So this could be a slave state, and that could be a slave state, and that could be a slave state. But anything above this line had to be a free state. Okay? Well, the problem with California in 1850, and anybody know why? I'll give a DVD to somebody and tell me why California was admitted before all the other states to the east of it were admitted way back in 1850. Can anybody tell me why California was first on the list?
Gold Rush.
That's right, Gold Rush. Give that man... You got a catch? Oh, let me know if that broke. I'll replace it.
I'll deliver.
Okay, we'll do it. Well, that's better. So when California was going to be admitted, notice the Southern California, which, you know, if you know something about our country, you might have an attitude about Southern California because of so many evil things that come out of there. But anyway, Southern California was being admitted as a free state. There were several enabling acts attempting to have California admitted as a free state, but they said, wait a minute, that's a violation of the Missouri Compromise. You've got a free state down here, and it's supposed to be entering as a slave state. Let's chop California in half, or this is two-thirds portion, and make that a slave state, and okay, that could be a free state north of that. But so the battle took place in trying in Congress to decide how California was going to enter the Union, and the fact of the matter is, no enabling act was approved. They debated it and they fought it back and forth, but there was not a majority that could agree as to how California was going to be admitted to the Union. So the people in California, frustrated by this process, year after year attempting to become a state, decided, forget it, we're just going to put together a constitution, we're going to send it to Congress and say, admit us. And you know what? Amazingly, Congress did admit them, and they admitted them as a free state. So the Missouri Compromise really didn't work out that well. The other aspect here, the reason Kansas is in white, is if you know what took place in Kansas, the battles that took place over Kansas were bloody. In fact, John Brown, a vicious terrorist on American soil is what I call him. You might think of him otherwise, but the history is that he went around murdering families in their beds at night simply because they believed slavery should be possible in Kansas. And so there was these battles that were taking place between terror groups, basically, to determine whether Kansas became a free state or a slave state. But wait a minute. Missouri Compromise said it should be a free state without any question. But the battles were taking place nonetheless. So the Missouri Compromise, a nice idea on paper, didn't really work out all that well in the history of the development of our country. Now, when Missouri was admitted, the Missouri Compromise, Missouri was the last state to be admitted supposedly above this line for the Missouri admitted as a slave state in 1821. And after Missouri was admitted, then they were saying, okay, this Missouri Compromise line is going to continue for the rest of the history of our country, which didn't work out so well. And Bleeding Kansas is one of the illustrations of that before, and some people say this was one of the battles that led up to the war between the states, or the war of northern aggression, or the war to prevent southern independence, whatever title you want to choose, but I won't choose the term civil war because it was not civil. But the bloodshed that took place in Kansas aroused sentiments both north and south. There were preachers in Brooklyn, who were raising funds to gather arms to get guns and ammunition to those who were opposed to slavery in Kansas so they could kill those who were for slavery in Kansas. Literally, preachers raising money to send guns to these terrorists who were going to kill those who thought Kansas ought to come in as a slave state. And so the battles went back and forth in Kansas before Kansas was admitted to the Union. Now, I'm going to need to skip over a bunch of this because some of this is going to take more time than we have. But Article 4, Section 3, we looked at, Congress shall have power to dispose of and make all needful rules and regulations respecting territory. A territory is a state that has not yet entered the Union. In other words, it has land and the territory is regulated directly by Congress. Anybody know what a territory, an example of a territory is today in America? Who said that? Okay, I won't throw it back there, but come on up and get it. Yes, Puerto Rico is one. Virgin Islands, there's a number of territories. They are not yet states. Potentially, they could become states, but currently, they are territories. And so Congress does have power to regulate and rule territories and other property belonging to the United States. And so when a state was moving towards admission to the Union, it was in this phase of being a territory ruled by a territorial governor who was appointed by Congress, and all the rules and regulations were controlled by Congress. If we go back to the first 13 states to join the Union, actually they joined the Union under something other than our Constitution, under the Articles of Confederation, right? And actually the Articles of Confederation were not fully ratified by all the original 13 states until the war was concluded. So the war for independence was going on, and there wasn't any full agreement among the 13 former colonies, now 13 free states that signed the Declaration of Independence. There wasn't even an agreement among them how they would interact with each other, which was part of the problem that made the war so difficult. But each of these 13 states claimed that their territory extended directly west and ended at the Mississippi River. So Virginia said, hey, we own all this territory all the way out to the Mississippi River. That's the state of Virginia. Pennsylvania likewise laid claim to it. So there's a conflict here between Pennsylvania and Virginia as to who owned these western territories. New York said, oh, hey, we own everything all the way up to the Mississippi River. And amazingly, Massachusetts right here, they claimed that they had a strip of territory that went all the way out to the Mississippi River. And likewise, North Carolina and Georgia and South Carolina. All of these states claim that these western lands that were uninhabited, basically they were wild territory at that point in time, and very few settlers were attempting to settle them. They claimed that all that was theirs. But in the Articles of Confederation, one of the things that took place is they agreed that each of these states would cede their claims to western territory. They would cede it to this new government being formed, this general government that was actually at the time in New York, not in Washington, D.C., so they gave up their western claims and they established these western boundaries. But in doing that, they ceded their territory to the federal government temporarily in order for the federal government to allow migration and settlement to 60,000, when each state had 60,000, or each territory had 60,000 settlers in it, then they could move towards statehood. They could begin to have a constitutional convention, could appeal for an enabling act from Congress. The process could begin by which these western territories would become states. So that was the first way in which the land grab began for the federal government. Anytime you give a government power, look out, it's going to abuse that power any way it possibly can. But the agreement was, we didn't give them this land that the federal government would own and control this land. No, we gave it to them with the intent that these lands would ultimately become states. So these 13 states ceded 235 million acres between the Appalachian Mountains and the Mississippi River between 1781 and 1802 when the final arrangements were made. Yes?
I want to make a comment. The reason they did it was because those lands were still inhabited by Indians.
Right.
And the states wanted the federal government to protect the new settlers going in there while they were forming these states from not only the hostile Indians, but also the British and other people who were there.
Trading and, yeah, right. So there was a bit of a turmoil, and actually states like North Carolina had a real problem because the people in their western territory, which ultimately became the state of Tennessee, were saying to the government of North Carolina, you have to send an army to come and protect us from the raids of the Indians. And North Carolina was saying, well, that's going to really be an expense that we cannot afford to manage. We cannot put together an army to protect all these scattered settlers throughout the region that ultimately became Tennessee. And so North Carolina was glad to turn that responsibility over to the federal government and say, it's your problem. You've got to build forts. You've got to man an army. You've got to protect the residents of the territory of Tennessee that ultimately became the state of Tennessee. So likewise, Virginia, when it ceded what became Kentucky, They likewise turned over the responsibility for protection and forts and so forth to the federal government rather than maintaining it themselves. Now, we'll skip over some of this here because there was land claims, especially up in what's modern-day Indiana, Ohio, and Illinois, and Michigan. There were land claims on the part of the British. So the British still said that was their territory and they were going to control it. And so it wasn't really until the War of 1812 that was finally settled. There were many people moving in and settling in the area where the ownership of the land was in dispute. Was it British? Was it American? Who owned and who controlled it? It was really not until the War of 1812 that was finally resolved. And the territory that we inhabit today, what's modern-day Ohio, it was called the Northwest Territory, all the land north and west of the Ohio River. So everything north and west of the Ohio River up to the Mississippi River was the Northwest Territory. And this was the first major chunk of land that came into the Union in the settlement of the agreements with Britain at the end of the War of 1812. The next big chunk of land doubled the size of our country was this chunk of land. And does anybody know who made that purchase? It was the Louisiana Purchase, Thomas Jefferson. Who said that? There you go, young man. Thomas Jefferson. Ah! I should let you deliver that. And Thomas Jefferson made a deal. Actually, it didn't start out that Thomas Jefferson intended to buy that much territory and double the size of the United States overnight. But he had a problem because there was a battle going on down here as to who controlled New Orleans. And whoever controlled New Orleans controlled all the Mississippi River. And at one point in time, you see, Spain owned not only East Florida, but West Florida, all the way up to New Orleans. And the French owned this side. So there was a battle between the French. And at one point in time, during the presidency of Thomas Jefferson, the Spanish took control of New Orleans, and they refused to allow any shipping of the United States to come down the Mississippi River through New Orleans. They basically blockade, which would have cut off all these western lands in terms of the trade. The way you got goods moved by water was the only way to move them in that day. The roads were in terrible, terrible condition. So Jefferson wanted to free Louisiana and take control of it in order for the Mississippi River to be able to be used by Americans. And so he went to Napoleon, or had his ambassadors go to Napoleon and appeal to him in terms of making a deal with Spain to allow New Orleans to be purchased by the United States. And Napoleon said, "Do I have a deal for you? I just don't want to sell you New Orleans. I want to sell you the entire Louisiana territory." And they jumped at it. In fact, the odd thing is that Jefferson recognized that this looks unconstitutional. In fact, he even said it so much so that he began to draft an amendment to the Constitution that would permit the United States government to purchase the Louisiana Territory, $15 million, which in that day, of course, was a lot of money, but still a real bargain. But he realized as he began to step through the process of putting together a constitutional amendment, the time it would take to get this amendment approved by both houses of Congress and then to get it out to the states, and how many states have to approve an amendment to the Constitution in order for that amendment to be valid and legal?
3/4.
I believe it was something like
37. Oh, the number, but I'm talking about the percentage. No? Who said 3/4? All right, you can come get this. I won't toss it. But so he recognized it was going to take a long time to get that many states to approve of this proposed amendment. And if they waited that long, he recognized what was going to take place was, hey, Napoleon would find another buyer, you know? Maybe the Spanish would buy it, or who knows? Maybe the Russian, who knows? But he realized that time was of the essence. And so he scrapped the plan to amend the Constitution, and he went ahead with a treaty, and formed a treaty with France in order to purchase, and the treaty involved the exchange of $15 million to purchase Louisiana territory. So, questionable, you know, was it constitutional or not? Is a treaty as they structured it, is that an approved way to purchase a large chunk of land as they did? Well, in addition to that, of course, other treaties brought in, Texas actually came in as its own nation. You know, that Texas seceded from Mexico on its own, terrible battles, and what took place there at the Alamo was all part of that. And it chose, once it seceded from Mexico to appeal to join the United States, and ultimately it was admitted as a state. Interestingly, it was a state that was admitted under the terms that it could split itself into five separate states if it chose to do so. And then, of course, the remainder of these territories, this was ceded from Britain in an agreement with Britain, and ultimately this was won by the war with the Spanish. So the whole idea of the federal government controlling the territories that ultimately came into its power were for temporary land ownership. Louisiana purchased 530 million acres, and Great Britain and Spain, 76 million acres in those years, 1817, 1819, 620 million acres via the purchases of treaties between 1846 and 1853. And the last major land purchase was Alaska, purchased from Russia, Seward's Folly, as it was known in that day, 378 million acres in 1867. So those are the ways in which large chunks of land came under the temporary ownership of the federal government, out of which the purpose was that they would establish states in each of those as the population increased and the process moving towards statehood. But those who reject our Constitution and its limits on the federal government's control and ownership of land, they say that the founders, the means by which the federal government came to own the lands, affect the laws that govern the management of that land. I'm quoting one of those apologists for the federal land grab. They would say, because the Louisiana Purchase came in by a purchase of the federal government, therefore the federal government has a different deal with those states in the Louisiana Purchase than it does with the first original 13 states. But that is not a constitutional position. This would mean that the states which joined the Union, formed from those territories acquired in this fashion, do not have the same powers which are possessed by those states who came into the Union by another means. In other words, the first 13 states. Thus, if they are correct in their interpretation of the Constitution, you have a two-tiered structure that certain states, the first 13, have powers that the remaining 37 states do not have. But that's not what our founder said. James Madison included provisions for equality in admittance of new states in the very first draft of the Constitution before it was approved. And he said, quote, if admission be consented to, new states shall be admitted on the same terms with the original states. Madison also insisted that Western states neither would nor ought to submit to a union which degraded them from an equal rank with other states. And so California, when it came in, and the federal government claiming, we own this part of the land of California, and we control that, they were entering the Union in a different deal with a different agreement than the first 13 states entered the Union. And that is not the intention of the framers of our Constitution at all. And so what's developed is what is called the legal footing doctrine from what George Mason, one of the founders, said. He said, quote, if the Western states are to be admitted to the Union, they must be treated as equals and subject to no degrading discrimination. They will have the same pride and other passions which we have, and will either not unite with us or will speedily revolt from the Union. Interesting note that he said there. If they join it and they find out they've got a bad deal, that they got cheated in this, that the Constitution has a two-tiered system and they're not being treated equally, they're going to leave. And they have every right to leave, George Mason was saying. They will speedily revolt from the Union if they are not in all respects placed on an equal footing with their brethren. And that phrase of George Mason's equal footing caught on and developed in what is called the equal footing doctrine that the Supreme Court, in this case, Escambia v. City of Chicago. The equal footing doctrine means that equality of constitutional right and power is the condition of all states of the Union, old and new. And this is 1883, when most of the territories by this point in time had entered in. The term equal footing doctrine comes from the state enabling acts. In other words, when states had an enabling act by which they were going to join the Union, almost all of those enabling acts used this phrase, into the Union on an equal footing with the original states in all respects whatsoever. And so my friend in California, challenging my thinking, I realized I needed to begin a research project that would discover when did this begin, what happened in order for this equal footing doctrine that was what our founders intended in the Constitution to have been violated. Where did that begin? Where was the first shot fired, so to speak, in this war that would prevent states from owning the land and controlling the land within their boundaries? And so I listed a couple of research assistants to help me look through all the enabling documents. So you got the first 13 states. They joined the Union. We know exactly how they joined the Union. They ratified the Constitution. Beyond those first 13, you got another 37 states that entered the Union by some process. There should be 37 state enabling acts. So we began this massive research project in which we tried to line up all 37 state enabling acts and research what took place in each of those enabling acts. We found out amazingly that 9 states were admitted to the Union without any enabling act at all. Vermont, Kentucky, Tennessee, Arkansas, Mississippi, Michigan, Florida, Kansas, Idaho, and Wyoming. I didn't put California on the list because California had an enabling act that was debated and fought back at 2 enabling acts, actually, but never had an approved enabling act. So we kind of left them off the list because at least there was a process of moving through an enabling act before they admitted to the Union, even though there was no approved enabling act. And so we discovered, as we began to research this, the U.S. Supreme Court clarified those rights, what those rights were, specifically of what it meant, the equal footing doctrine. In the context of land, the equal footing doctrine has been held to mean, for example, that states have the authority over the beds of navigable waterways. Now, this may not be a question that ever concerns you or even thought of, but if you go to the Mississippi River, who owns the land and controls the land under the bed of the Mississippi River? Now, there's 2 states that would claim, you know, some territorial ownership of that. And if there's a debate about it and it has to go to court as to who controls that waterbed underneath, the Supreme Court said each respective state, not the federal government, each respective state where its territory, if it's drawn down the center line of the Mississippi, each respective state owns and controls that land under the navigable bed, over the beds of the navigable waterways. Of course, if it's within a state, so a river entirely within the state of Indiana, the Supreme Court would say Indiana as a state then has full control and authority over that. It's interesting, in my state, Maryland, the debate between Maryland and Virginia, and actually some of the wars, the oyster wars that took place, were over that exact point. Because Maryland says, and you know, there is some legal precedent to say this is true, it owns the land under the navigable waterway of the Chesapeake Bay up until the low water mark. So Virginia doesn't own any of the navigable waterway of Chesapeake Bay, built from the low water mark on down. And so that kind of thing was established in time. And basically the Supreme Court saying there's an equal footing doctrine in how land ownership is treated. A doctrine in some language within the Supreme Court case of Pollard's Lessees v. Hagen in 1845 provide an argument that the federal government held the land ceded by the original states only temporarily pending their disposal. So that agreement was clear, at least up until the midpoint of the 19th century. It's clear that the equal footing doctrine prohibits permanent federal land ownership. And that's the point that is very, very plain, even though it was beginning to be violated in the middle of the 19th century. Well, let's come up to our day. This is the year 2010. This is a Department of Interior secretarial order by Salazar, appointee of Obama, would lock up tens of millions of land, acres of land, that the federal government claims that it controls. These lands are currently allowed for farmers to graze their cattle on, or ranches to graze their cattle, timber companies to cut timber from, mining companies to mine minerals and resources, and oil companies to drill oil. These, quote, federal lands, up to this point in time, have been allowed to be used, the resources of those lands have been allowed to be used by companies within the states those lands occur in. Well, this Secretarial Order 3310 would have locked up all of those lands, tens and millions of acres, to say no more timbering, there'll be no more mining, there'll be no more cattle ranching. None of that can take place on federal lands. Well, wait a minute. If it's federal lands, where do they get the constitutional power to do that? Where do they get the constitutional power to say no motorized vehicles or motorized equipment? Obviously, that means no mining, no timbering. Nothing can take place on that land unless it's foot traffic, right? Well, when we think about, we've talked about these dates of admission. Rhode Island, by the way, was the very last to join the Union. And note the interesting dates there that when the 9th state joined the Constitutional Union, The Constitution became active for those 9 states alone. Now, immediately after, of course, Virginia and New York, within a month, joined the Union. So there was 11 states. But 2 states remained separate. North Carolina and Rhode Island, in a sense, had their own separate country under the Articles of Confederation, while the other 11 states had formed a new country under the U.S. Constitution. 2 separate countries until Rhode Island and North Carolina joined. But when they joined, the power that they had as states, this equal footing doctrine was supposed to be how all the rest of the states joined. Vermont joined in an interesting fashion because there was a battle between New York and New Hampshire as to who owned and controlled the territory called Vermont. Finally, they settled the battle by doing this. Both New York and New Hampshire ceded that territory, said, "We will not control that territory. We will allow the people of that territory to form their own state." And Vermont was admitted to the Union by proposing its own constitution, and there was no enabling act. Kentucky, we already mentioned. Virginia ceded Kentucky, and again, they just proposed a constitution and no enabling act. Tennessee was ceded from North Carolina, and again, no enabling act there. So the next state, the very first state in which there was an enabling act that Congress had to look at and consider and vote to approve was Ohio, that was admitted March 1st, 1803. And I think those of you who know a little bit about the history of Ohio, there was some mistake made, and Ohio was not admitted legally until
1953.
Yeah, because they didn't do it right back then in 1803. So there was a bunch of mistakes made. And so when we're working through this, excuse me, this research project, we began to look at Ohio as the first enabling act that we could actually look on paper to see what was the agreement by which Ohio was entered into the Union. And Ohio was the first state in this Northwest Territory that was all the land above that section, states by state who won't take. But let's look at Ohio's Enabling Act. Section 1 said that Ohio shall be admitted into the Union upon the same footing with the original states in all respects whatsoever. And if it's all respects whatsoever, it must be all, right? So they are to have the same authority over the land in Ohio as all the other states that came into the Union. 1/20th part, however, notice what Section 7 says because it's already deviating. 1/20th part of the net proceeds from the lands lying within the said state sold by Congress from and after the 30th day of June next. By the way, the 30th day of June next meant 3 months after Ohio was formally admitted to the Union. So 3 months after Ohio became a state, who's selling land within the jurisdiction of Ohio? Congress, according to this Enabling Act. Congress shall sell it. And 1/20th, in other words, 20% of those funds, after deducting all expenses incident to the same, shall be applied to the laying out and making public roads leading from the navigable waterways, emptying into the Atlantic, to the Ohio, and to the said state. So Congress is saying, we're going to determine where the roads are built, how the roads are built, and we're going to fund the building of those roads with a sale of land that Congress is in control of. Wait a minute. This is a direct violation of the Constitution. Once that state achieves statehood, once it becomes sovereign, that land is no longer the federal government's land. We know why the federal government was doing this. It was in debt. Big time debt. It had debts, huge debts, from the War of Independence that were yet unpaid and other debts that were piling up. So Congress was choosing to pay its debt by selling these lands as the means of meeting that need. Instead of saying, no, we're going to turn this land over to the state of Ohio, allow Ohio to sell that land and deal with it that way, and allow Ohio to be in the decision-making seat as to where roads are going to be built and why those roads are going to be built and how those roads are going to be funded. So here, from the very first Enabling Act that ever existed in our country, the deal was already gone wrong. In other words, they were already acting unconstitutionally in 1803. Then it goes on to say, through some same such roads to be laid out under the authority of Congress, not the state government, authority of Congress, and some might argue with me and say, well, Article 1, Section 8 does permit the building of post roads, but there's no mention in this Enabling Act of post roads, and indeed, the implication of these roads that are being built is that they are for commerce. They are to the navigable waterways from the interior, they're for commerce. They're not for post roads, and there's no statement that they're for post roads. So the authority of Congress, with the consent of the several states through which the roads shall pass, provided always that the three foregoing propositions herein offered are on the condition that the convention of the said state shall provide by an ordinance irrevocable. Notice it says an irrevocable ordinance, a law that can never be changed without the consent of the United States. It should be states there. And that that every and each tract of land sold by Congress from and after the 30th day of June next shall be and remain exempt from any tax laid by or order or under the authority of the state, whether for state, county, township, or other purpose whatsoever, for the term of 5 years from and after the date of the sale. I don't look like property tax any more than anybody else does. But notice what it's saying here. If you buy your land from the federal government, you have it tax-free for 5 years. If you buy your land from any other individual in the state of Ohio or from the government of the state of Ohio, you don't have a tax-free deal. You get a special deal if you buy your land from the federal government. So what are new settlers going to do? They're going to buy it from the federal government. It's the cheapest. It's the best deal going. And then they continued, because Ohio, the Constitution, the Convention of Ohio, responded to Congress in a conversation here, and their reply to this Enabling Act, do resolve to accept of the said propositions, providing the following additions to and modification of the said propositions shall be agreed to by the Congress, that not less than 3% of the net proceeds of the land of the United States lying within the limits of the state of Ohio, sold and to be sold after the 30th day of June last, shall be applied in laying out of roads within the state. So they agreed in principle, yeah, the federal government owns this land, and the federal government can sell this land. They were just dickering about the details, that is, how much money was going to be expended to actual land and the building of these roads. Where did they get this idea from? Well, they didn't get it from the Constitution, because I already showed you the Constitution said you can't do that. The federal government can't own that land. They get it from the Northwest Ordinance, July 13, 1787, which said the legislatures of those districts or new states shall never interfere with the primary disposal of the soil by the United States in Congress assembled, nor with any regulations Congress may find necessary for securing the title in such soil to bona fide purchasers. No tax shall be imposed on the lands, the property of the United States. They got the idea from the Northwest Ordinance. And so the important question is, well, let me continue with the Northwest Ordinance. Any of the said states shall have 60,000 free inhabitants therein. Such state shall be admitted by its delegates into the Congress of the United States on equal footing with the original states in all respects whatever, and shall be at liberty to form a permanent constitution and state government thereof. So the question is, which came first, the chicken or the egg? The Northwest Ordinance or the U.S. Constitution? The Northwest Ordinance was ratified by Congress July 13th, 1787, while at the same time the Constitutional Convention was happening down in Philadelphia, and they were hammering out the details. That wasn't approved until finally September 17th of that same year, 1787. And you know, it wasn't finally ratified until June 21st, 1788, when New Hampshire ratified the Constitution. So which came first? The Northwest Ordinance. So you might assume the Northwest Ordinance is the governing law, and the Constitution must submit to the Northwest Ordinance. Oh, but not so. Consider what Article 4, Section 2 says. This Constitution, the laws of the United States, which shall be made in pursuance thereof, shall be the supreme law of the land. Northwest Ordinance was overruled by the Constitution according to Article 4, Section 2 of the Constitution, and therefore it should not be the governing document as it became for Ohio. We won't take time to look at Louisiana. Basically, the same deal was Louisiana would enter the Union under the same kind of enabling act that said the federal government can build roads, and also the federal government can build levies and control those levies and so on as they were. So Ohio was the first, Louisiana, and you begin to study these enabling acts and you find the same pattern state after state after state, Indiana, Mississippi, Illinois, and on down. Each of these had statements to that effect in their enabling acts. And so as the new states joined the Union, they joined under this unconstitutional bargain that allowed the federal government supposedly to control these lands. The last state, Alaska, when it came in.
Could you but make the argument, and I think they did, is that the Northwest Ordinance took precedence over the Constitution because there was no revocation of the Northwest Ordinance in the Constitution. Instead, it was actually supported. So the chicken and egg thing still exists.
Mm-hmm. And I think their argument is wrong because the Constitution says it is the supreme law of the land. But that you're right, that is their argument. But if their argument is true, then the equal footing doctrine that has been supported all the way through is false. And in fact, each enabling act has a phrase somewhat similar to that. If they don't say equal footing doctrine, they say you entered this union on the same footing as the original 13. which the Northwest Ordinance doesn't permit. So there's a contradiction taking place.
Yeah, but you have a Northwest, you have an equal footing phrase in the Northwest Ordinance.
But it's not an equal footing to come into the Union and have the federal government control a chunk of land.
I see what you're saying, but it would be a battle in the courts, I think.
Oh, it would be. But, well, I won't look at Alaska because there's no time to do all of Alaska. But Alaska basically says the federal government owns this enormous amount of territory of Alaska and controls it. And they were going to give a gift of 24% of that land to the state of Alaska so the state of Alaska could control it. And when you look at, it may not be such an issue here in Indiana and Ohio where it's a very small percentage of the land is controlled or claimed to be controlled by the federal government. Look at the poor state of Nevada. 84% of the land is controlled and claimed to be under the control of the federal government. 69% of Alaska and so on. So these western states have an enormous problem, but some of those western states have begun to wake up to, I'm going to have to skip through much because we're just about out of time here, the state of Nevada being one of them. They have begun to wake up to the power they have to interpose against the federal government's encroachment. Utah legislation passed the House 61-9, state jurisdiction of federally managed lands joint resolution said, be it resolved that the legislature of the state of Utah calls on the United States through their agent Congress to relinquish to the state of Utah all right, title, and jurisdiction in those lands that were committed to the purposes of this state by terms of its enabling act, compact with them, and that now reside within the state as public lands managed by the Bureau of Land Management and were reserved by Congress after the date of Utah's statehood. And they continue, the federal trust respecting public lands obligates the United States through their agent Congress to extinguish both their governmental jurisdiction and their title on the public lands that are held in trust by the United States for the states in which they are located. So there's some states that are waking up to the power they have to say, wait a minute, this deal is wrong. We entered this, even if that was what the Enabling Act said, we entered it on the wrong footing. We do not have an equal footing doctrine, and we demand to be restored to that. And the states can do that. For example, in Nevada, there was an issue. Bureau of Land Management was telling ranchers, you cannot graze your cattle on this land that you've been grazing it on for 100 years. You can't do that anymore. This land is off limits to you as a rancher. And the rancher said, oh, heck with that. That's just stupid bureaucrats in Washington, D.C. He continued to graze his cattle. And they sent a warning. They said, we are going to come and take the cattle. And this was, Nye County, Nevada. The sheriff, knowing his powers, wrote to the federal government and said, don't you come dare do that. I will arrest you and put you in prison because that is theft. You're not going to steal the cattle from a resident or a citizen in my jurisdiction. And they back and forth went. Finally, the sheriff basically said, okay, bring it on. You want to exchange lead? I don't think he used that exact term, but that was his implication. You want to exchange lead? Fine. Come on out here to Nevada. We know how to shoot, and I think we can shoot you bureaucrats. So the Bureau of Land Management backed off and said, okay, we're not going to go steal those cattle. There's other incidences around the country where sheriffs in particular are waking up to the power they have to prevent the federal government from violating the law in stealing the land, and they are beginning the interposition process by which these lands can be, in a sense, reclaimed by the states. There's a whole lot more here that I don't have time to deal with, but well, let me just look at that Texas bill because that was an interesting... hang on a second here. Is that the Texas bill? The bill has been pre-filed 2011 state legislative session creating penalties up to $5,000 in fines, up to 5 years in jail, anyone guilty of the felony to enforce an act, law, order, statute, or regulation of Obamacare. So if the state says, not only is this wrong, which is nullification, we nullify that law, Obamacare, we're going to penalize, we're going to put guys in prison who attempt to enforce this, that's interposition, that's taking the next step, that's putting teeth into the nullification. Just saying the law doesn't exist or the law is wrong is nullifying it. Interposing is when the government of the states actually take the power into their hands and begin to arrest people, begin to put them on notice. We've got zero time left. If you want more information on this, I did bring some videos of this presentation, which are much longer than the opportunity I had to present here. Thank you so much.
If you're interested in learning more, actually attending Camp American, we would invite you to do so. Again, June 15th through the 21st in 2014. June 15th through the 21st. You can send your children, 12 and up. You can come yourself as a volunteer, or you can actually come as an adult student. So again, there is plenty to learn, and there's great speakers. Go to www.campamerican.com. That's www.campamerican.com to get more information. And again, we would invite you to come up and learn more about the things that you've been hearing on these programs. So we're out of time for this week. I would ask you to join me again next week, and hopefully Barry will be back for another Principles and Policies.